Welcome back to 45 North. I'm Ann Strangeamps. Have you ever had one of those trips or adventures of a lifetime? The kind of experience that shapes you, that you're still thinking about years later? For Wisconsin writer Julie Buckles, it was her honeymoon trip, a long, cold canoe expedition into the wilderness from Washburn, Wisconsin, to northern Saskatchewan in the Canadian Arctic. 14 years later, she is still thinking and writing about that trip, and she's just published a memoir about it called Paddling to Winter.
It was May of 1999, day four of my 1,700-mile canoe honeymoon. Charlie and I had kicked off from our backyard at the Sioux River Beach near Washburn, and we had paddled to Lake Superior's Bark Bay near Cornucopia. The plan was to paddle historic Voyageur routes from Lake Superior through the Boundary Waters and then further west and north to northern Saskatchewan, where we would stay for the winter. We were following a line I had seen drawn on a map on Charlie's wall during one of our first dates. He had completed several canoe expeditions in the far north in his youth, but never from Lake Superior, and never with me. This trip seemed to be the perfect beginning to our marriage. But first, we had to survive Lake Superior, the body of water I feared most for her size, her fierceness, and chill. She had measured in at a mere 35 degrees that day. I looked ahead and saw frothy white waves, but I couldn't make sense of them. I bowed my head and focused on paddling through gentle swells. But then waves 4 feet high broke over the shoal to our side. Charlie steered the canoe forward, perpendicular to the waves. I knew that if a wave hit us sideways, we would be upside down and up that fabled creek. I didn't have time to think or to look, only to react. I kept my head down and my paddle in the water. One wave, two waves, three waves, four. Finally through, Charlie turned the canoe to the left to round the point. "We made it through," he started to say, then barked, "Draw right!" I pulled the canoe right with my paddle and stared up at a wave. I dug in just as the wave lifted us into the air. We teetered on top of a 3-foot crest, pausing for what seemed like minutes. Long enough for me to look down at the shallow, almost tranquil pool below and the smooth, round rocks beneath the surface. "Brace!" Charlie screamed as the canoe crashed down. The next wave broke right in front of me, smashing gallons of ice water onto my chest. I couldn't breathe. My heart pounded and my right leg shook uncontrollably. I couldn't believe we were still upright. I wanted to cry, but there wasn't time. We had to keep paddling through one breaking wave after another until finally all that remained were rolling swells and about 100 pounds of water in the bottom of the canoe. We camped that night near Herbster, and the next day we loaded the canoe and paddled on toward our destination, one paddle stroke at a time. Author Ginger Strand wrote that your honeymoon tells the world, and maybe you, who you are. During the next 4 months of paddling and 8 months of winter, the land, the weather, and the people told us exactly who we were. Two people connected in rough seas and in calm water.
That's Julie Buckles with a Wisconsin Life essay adapted from her new book, Paddling to Winter. Julie teaches at Ashland College in northern Wisconsin, and she joins us this morning. Welcome, Julie. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. And that's actually Northland College in Ashland.
Oops, sorry. Thank you for the correction. Northland College in Ashland. So most newlyweds would rather find a beach somewhere for their honeymoon, or at least not such a cold beach as those you found. An 18-month wilderness expedition to the Canadian Arctic. Why?
It's a little extreme, isn't it? Well, there's a couple of, different answers to that question. The why is a hard one. I've had a tough time answering that as people ask me that. I guess the biggest answer was it sounded exciting, and I was curious about that part of the world. It's a part of the world my husband, Charlie, had grown to love in his youth as he did expeditions two or three times with a camp and then with friends. And he talked and talked about it, and it was just, I guess if we were going to spend a life together, it was a part of the world I wanted to see with him.
I love that you saw a map on the wall in his apartment on one of your very first dates, a map of the old Voyageur routes. Yep. I guess these are historic routes. I don't actually know that much about them.
Well, they were the the transportation that drove the commerce of North America for more than 200 years. The voyagers would haul out furs and gather supplies and go back. So it was a route that really does make sense, and it has that great kind of historic element to it, and that really appealed to me. I was a history major at UW-Madison, and so history's always had an appeal, and that was one of the things I was really curious about, was to see this landscape that for hundreds of years Native people and voyagers traveled back and forth.
Sort of like visiting an old highway.
Yeah, the Voyager Highway, but a waterway.
So this trip happened 14 years ago. You know, you and Charlie are still married. You have kids. You've done a lot of living since then. Why write about it now? I mean, what was it about that trip that you either haven't been able to forget or wanted to try to remember?
Well, there's a, you know, it's the publishing industry, so I didn't exactly write it this year. And so I actually started writing about it. But that is an interesting point to that. I was a reporter, and so writing is something that comes very natural to me. It's what I do. And when we left on the trip, people had even joked, were you going to write a book about this? And I had never intended to. It was really something done in the purest spirit of just wanting to go out and see the world and not necessarily report it or blog about it or do any of those things that we do now about our daily lives. And so I set off with that thought that we're just going to do this together for us. But then when I got back and I started graduate school a couple of years later after I had returned, and the essays kept popping up about that trip, and every time an essay would get in front of a writer's group, there would be so many questions like, well, you have to explain why you did it and how you did it and what, where, how, when. And the essays started to expand, and suddenly I had the start of a book. Children started coming along in that period. And so it was really over the last couple of years that I finished it, found a publisher, and then got to the actual printing phase.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the book is part adventure story, but also in some ways part marriage manual. I mean, I can't imagine a quicker way to test a marriage or break it than marooning yourself in the wilderness with your partner. I mean, what was that like? How did it affect your relationship?
Well, it certainly, yeah, it takes all those elements of marriage that we all know so well and are rather tedious on some days and rather dramatic on other days and pours it into an 18-foot canoe for 14 months and then onto an island for 8 months. So it was very intense. And I think we had the great joy or to work out a lot of stuff very quickly, which, you know, made the next years very easy.
Like what? What did you work out?
Well, the one thing people have teased my husband about since reading it is his tone of voice. And he has this awful tone of voice when he is under stress, but it does no good there. And so, you know, that happens a couple of times through rapids, and you get out of the canoe and you say, that's not working. And he uses the tone of voice again through another set of rapids. And what happens when he uses that tone of voice is I freeze, and you get out of the canoe and you say, it's still not working. And eventually he just stops doing it. So I would say that on his side, he really kind of came out of that relying on that tone of voice when he was stressed out.
Yeah, there's one story you tell, though. You've got to tell the story about, I can't remember if it was rapids or what, but you had your dog with you for a while, your Siberian husky. And I know you know which story I'm thinking about.
Yeah. Well, and that's a funny scene because that's the one scene I went to Charlie with and said, are you sure you're okay with this being in the book? And he said, I am fine with all of my character flaws showing in this book. So, but that was the only scene that I really wanted to check in with him because it's not very flattering. But yes, we're making a very large crossing, and it's a very stressful situation because there's waves. And I've brought my husky, and huskies are not very keen on water.
So you take her on a canoe trip.
I know. Well, yeah, I really wanted her along. And so water's splashing up and over the canoe, and she's freaking out. She wants to get up and over my shoulder. And what she wants to do is get to the high point, which is the middle of the canoe. But what she's doing is making the boat that much more unstable. And so Charlie yells forward, kill that dog if you have to. And I just went into this mode of like, I know who I want to kill right now. And we get to the island, and this was a great marriage moment. I wanted to just walk away. I wanted to leave. I wanted to just go be by myself for days, which is how I, at that time, dealt with conflict. But you couldn't. We had to deal with each other. We were all we had. And so we had to just own up to Charlie said, that's a character flaw, and I had to forgive him, and we moved on. But it was a very quick resolution, much quicker than I think many fights play out.
Uh-huh. And you were starting to say before I got you to tell that story, what did you bring to the trip?
I think you found that with that scene as well. My mode of communication, certainly at the start of our marriage, was to shut down, to go into silent mode. I'm very Midwestern in that way, and to not just verbalize and say, here's what's bothering me and here's what I don't like. Instead, I would just like kind of go internally. But you can't do that when you're working together every day, every moment. We were 15 feet apart for 4 months, and we had to, you know, land and then get our gear together. And there's really no room for pouting, which was, I guess, is actually what my mode was. You just have to buck up and move on. So I think it was great lessons in just get over yourself.
Mm. And I talk about the details of the trip. I mean, you were planning an 18-month expedition. You guys were young. Mm-hmm. How could you even afford to take a whole year off?
Well, because we were young. I don't think it's anything we could do now. At that point, we didn't have a mortgage. In fact, I think our only debt at that point was I had a little bit of a student loan left. We were in our late 20s, so we weren't super young. But we hadn't yet gotten into debt. And that is really the largest barrier to any of us, I think, taking a year off. And it's something we talk about doing now with our children. And it's a lot more difficult in your 30s and 40s as you get more tangled into debt. And and we both had jobs, but we had jobs that we could leave and come back to. I was a reporter at the Daily Press. Charlie worked in forestry. And so we were pretty secure in that. We had a house that we owned outright, and so we rented it. It was a little teeny cabin, but we rented that for the year, and so that paid any expenses associated with that. So in a lot of ways, it was much easier to leave then than it would be now.
Mm. And your plan was you were going to canoe up to the Canadian Arctic. I don't know. I mean, how
yes.
far were you going to go first, and how much of that was paddling and how much was portaging?
Well, the original intent of the trip was to paddle the 1,700 miles, which would be following the Voyager route. And then we would basically hop off onto a side road of the Voyager Highway on to Wollaston Lake. And there we would stay for the winter, which we did. The full intention was, and the winter over portion is something that makes the trip a bit unusual. You know, there's plenty of expeditions that go on every year of a paddling trip or one portion of a trip, but we wanted really to stay for the winter and absorb the land in all seasons. But what happened in April, as we were ready to depart, we got a call that Charlie's dad was very ill, and so we were forced to basically call off the trip at that point. Mm-hmm. And so returned home.
Well, I want to talk more about winter as we're heading into winter ourselves, and many of us are feeling like we'd like to flee. There are, of course, people who want to head toward it, as the title of your book is, Paddling to Winter. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Julie Buckles. She's a reporter and freelance writer. She teaches journalism at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin, and we're talking about her new book, Paddling to Winter: A Couple's Wilderness Journey from Lake Superior to Northern Canada. And this hour, we are calling all paddlers and adventurers to share your story. Have you had an adventure with your family or somebody close to you, and how did it affect your relationship? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. Or you can chime in on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. Coming up at 9 tonight, it's the Moth Radio Hour. This week, a special live edition of the Moth's collaboration with the World Science Festival. An astrophysicist discovers wild parallels in her research and romantic life. A surgeon details his involvement in one of the world's first ever hand transplants. And a geneticist is called to testify in a murder. That's all coming up at 9 tonight on the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Ann Strangehamps, and right now we're talking with Julie Buckles, Wisconsin writer and author of a brand new book, Paddling to Winter. And Julie, we were talking about winter. You did the exact opposite of what most people do, which is headed toward winter rather than away from it. You are actually a fan of winter, though, right?
I am, and it becomes a theme because 2 years after this particular trip, we returned with sled dogs with the intent of, it was that one winter that really didn't come for us, and we're like, well, heck, we're going to go find it, and took a month and went winter camping and dog sledding in the north. And as you know from reading the book, while we're on an island in a cabin with no electricity or running water, we still go out to even more extreme conditions and go winter camping as well. So, yeah, we're kind of nuts that way.
Well, before we hear a little bit more about your winter stories, we've got Marilyn on the line from Montfort. Let's see if she's got a story to share. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. I had an opportunity to go to Costa Rica. I'd never been to the tropics before. And I was to help a researcher who had hurt her neck and needed somebody just to be her dog's body and carry things for her. And I ended up also having my sister, who lives in Oregon, come with us. And we hadn't done anything together since we had been camping as children. And it was... not only was it a wonderful bonding experience, but the whole idea of going into the rainforest at 4:30 every morning and helping collect the howler monkey poop.
Howler monkey poop?
Yes. And it was just an amazing experience. We slept in a cabin that first was infested with ants, and we had to move. From that, and we moved to a cabin that was infested with bats, and learned to appreciate the whole experience.
Marilyn, do you think the experience of doing that with your sister changed your relationship with your sister at all?
Oh yes, without a doubt. And when we saw the need they had, we were in a very remote region of Costa Rica. The schools were just very bad. We ended up working through her church and my church, and we went back and renovated the school and brought supplies, and then we worked on a medical clinic, and we did this together for 14 times.
Wow.
And it was a wonderful experience.
Wow. So what started out as just one trip turned into really...
Yeah, and I had a good relationship with my sister, but I mean, you know... sharing a cabin and going through the hardships, just tackling the rainforest and climbing up and down.
Yeah, that's a great story. Thank you for calling to share it with us. And we've got room for you if you are listening and have a story of an adventure, especially an adventure with a family or somebody close to you, and I'm curious to know how it affected your relationship. There's room for you to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. Julie, that's, I think, at the heart of why you did this kind of expedition and have done others with your husband. What is it about being in the wilderness or in a very, very remote place with somebody else that changes relationships, do you think?
Well, and I think not only changes relationships, but changes in an individual. And I think we can say that about all travel done in the purest spirit of just going out and wanting to find out more about the rest of the world. And there's this Pico Ayer a quote that I love from an essay that he wrote about why we travel. And he writes, the first great joy of traveling is simply the luxury of leaving all my beliefs and certainties at home. and seeing everything I thought I knew in a different light and from a crooked angle. And I think we start to see maybe one another in a different light and from those crooked angles. And it can only deepen our relationships with each other and with the world and with the land. And, you know, that's that year of being on the trail. And, you know, people start to think about anything above, you know, Lake Superior as being absolute wilderness and desolate. And here we were meeting people all along the way that live there and seeing signs of generations of people who had lived there. And just felt, I could just feel the landscape kind of moving inside of me as we moved along. And then also just, yeah, my relationship with Charlie and how we interacted, you could just feel it deepen as we went. And that sense that we are in it for the long haul and that we will always have each other's backs.
Mm-hmm. We've got Andy on the line from Marinette is calling maybe with the story. Hi, Andy. Do you have a story to share?
Yeah, just cool program and thanks. Very cool story. I'm going to have to buy this book. So I'm a whitewater river guide in northern Wisconsin with Coza's Rafting, and we offer guided trips on the Menominee and the Peshtigo Rivers. The Peshtigo River is kind of a marriage tester in late summer in that the water can get quite low, and if you don't steer right, if you don't work together, you can get stuck on a rock, say, every 15 to 20 feet, and this is a five-mile trip, right? So we kind of joke to ourselves as guides, and we say, you know, if you're engaged and you want to find out if it's meant to be, go ahead and book a trip on the Peshtigo River in low water. If you can come off that river and at least make eye contact with the other person, go ahead. It's meant to be. You'll weather any storm. So I just want to offer my sincere congratulations to your guests and her husband's for completing such a cool adventure.
That's great.
I admire it and envy it.
Thank you, Andy. That's great. I'm not sure.
We are on board because I actually have the same thought. I've told many people, go for a five-day paddle, and it's much more useful maybe than those counseling sessions they make you go to when you're going to get married, because it does absolutely involve having to work together and to navigate a stretch together. And if you can't navigate maybe that five-mile stretch in low water, maybe should think of looking elsewhere before you get married.
Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, you're talking about testing, and really you need to see each other in your worst lights. So.
Yeah, isn't that when all character comes out, is when you're at your worst? And so, yeah, when you see each other like that on a daily basis, you're going to see all the quirks for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've also got Bob calling from Albion. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm enjoying your show very much. I thought I'd tell you my little story about in the 70s, I worked as a fisherman in Alaska, and I used to leave my then-girlfriend, now-wife, for a couple of months at a time and then come back. And finally, just before we were going to get married, she said, well, I'd like to, sort of like your guest, she said, I'd like to see what's going on up there. And we went and got on the boat in Seattle, and I said we were the cooks, and we rode up the Inside Passage across the Gulf of Alaska, around the Alaska Peninsula, and then spent the summer tendering salmon in Bristol Bay at the mouth of the Naknek River. And she really hated it to begin with, and I remember when we'd go into town on occasion, she was the only woman on a boat full of men, and you know, we had to serve a meal every 6 hours, and it was pretty much just work, eat, sleep. And she went in on the little skiff to pick up something in town, and she came back and she said, I'm leaving. I'm hiking out of here. I had to take her up to the wheelhouse and show her the chart and say, you know, honey, there are roads there, but you can't get there from here. They don't go anywhere.
Oh, my God, this poor woman's trapped on a boat with all these men. And
yeah, but, you know, I wanted to say now we do a lot of canoeing. We do a big couple of whitewater trips every summer, and we do a big camping trip. And I agree that canoeing is a great way to learn to get along. We have friends who can't canoe and have to kayak. They have to accept it.
So, oh, thanks. That's a great story.
I love that story, and the one piece I can really identify with is that being the only woman in a landscape of men. For 4 months, it's mostly men in the north and on the trails, and I really missed that female companionship, that easy laughter, and that come on in, that You know, women have, and men don't have as much. And when we found women along the way, I was definitely one to kind of sponge up and take it in when I could. And when we were on that island for 8 months of winter, it was me and a bunch of men.
Mm. And when you occasionally, you talked about meeting people who sort of live way out back of beyond. When you met women, were they like, come in, honey?
Yes. And that's what I love about women. And I have, well, I really only met one. So her name was Ann Monkman on Lake Winnipeg. But she right away said, come on in. And they made, but that's, you know, that was actually the spirit of the North. The men did that as well. I don't think ever in my life will I again get that kind of true hospitality of having someone invite you in, sit at their kitchen table, drink coffee, make a round of bannock, which is a kind of a fry bread, and full attention to telling stories and interacting. And we had about six examples of that along the way. No televisions, no computers, no hand devices, just full attention. And I really thought that was super special.
Well, it's kind of a testament to how incredibly rich life becomes when you take away everything we think we need.
Oh, I know. You untangle and unplug. And I think that's what is the appeal of the wilderness. It is for me as we continue on in our lives. And we have continued to paddle every year. And we take our children to the Boundary Waters. And this last year, we took them back up to near Wollaston to the Churchill River. But you get out, and there's no debate. There's no turn it off. There's no look at me. It's you all have each other's full attention. And that was, I guess, the gift that Charlie and I gave to each other by setting off on that kind of crazy type of honeymoon and allowing ourselves a time to really kind of absorb each other and pay attention.
Well, let's hear some other stories from other folks. Bill's calling from Waukesha. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted to relate a story of how I raised my daughter from the time she was probably about 6 years old. We started traveling together, and I'm a photographer, so I typically travel west, and I camp on BLM land where I'm away from everybody so I can be someplace where I can photograph evenings and mornings stuff. So I started taking my daughter on these trips, and she got really used to just van camping, but very primitive, you know, no campgrounds, just out on BLM land. And we would just see, you know, incredible skies at night with shooting stars. And we'd see animals that, you know, most people don't get an opportunity to see. And we've also met some really interesting people in our travels as well. And she's 18 now, and she has a real appreciation for nature and preserving nature and animals. And I think it all goes back to how she was raised and spend time traveling.
God, what a wonderful upbringing. And you were talking about BLM lands, Bureau of Land Management. But so is that illegal? Or because we're so used to, you know, by now thinking even if we're going to head into the wilderness, we have to stop at official campsites.
No, BLM land is basically public land, and you can camp anywhere out on BLM land. And what's really nice is very few people do it. So when we go out in these places, mostly in Western states, Utah, Montana, you know, Nevada, you can get away from everybody, and you're pretty much on your own.
Hmm. Did you have that?
Again, there's no facilities, but, you know, we end up swimming in streams and hot springs, and, you know, we find some really beautiful spots when we're out like that.
Oh, that sounds great. Thanks. Julie, did you have experiences like that where, you know, you were really so far out there weren't even campsites, you just had to find your own spots?
Yeah, that was 90% of our trip. The Boundary Waters, of course, is all Boundary Waters is, which is, it's kind of interesting. It's the true or the technical wilderness area, but outside of the Boundary Waters, there's lots of wilderness that's just not regulated. So yeah, beyond, and what was really cool is because we were on the Voyageur Highway, is that there's natural campsites. They're not true campsites with facilities or anything, but you can see that they are spots because they make sense, like a flat rock on a point, because to be out on a point means that you're going to keep the bugs down because there's a breeze and that's flat, and so you have a good view. And you could tell that probably for hundreds of years people have camped at that spot. Mm-hmm. But it's not a spot that has a fire ring and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, but that's the type of camping we were doing all along the way.
That's lovely. You must kind of feel the, I don't know, in a landscape in which you see no other humans for miles, to see just the traces. Yeah. But I think even just feeling the trace of, you know, your kind left behind on a rock or a spit of land, that must.
Yeah, there's a spot in the Boundary Waters where you pass through, and you could, I almost felt like if I looked up, I would see Native people standing up, because it's such a natural lookout point. And there's that sense as you travel through that route, we would find traces of, my husband's going to tell me later, but Knife Lake, I think it's called, and you could see the flint where they used to make, from shards, they would make knives. And so there's just all these, the traces, as you said, as you travel through that landscape, that are not set up as what are being, you know, used today.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Let's hear from Brad, who is calling from Tomahawk, Wisconsin. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I think your story is just great, and I hope people read your book and become encouraged. My wife and I were married in 2000, and we took a year off and traveled the world for our honeymoon. We quit our jobs and quit our life, and anything we didn't need, we got rid of. We traveled mostly in Southeast Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam. We spent 4 months in Nepal, trekking in the Annapurna Circuit. My wife got frostbite on her toes crossing a pass in a winter storm, and it was just an amazing experience that set our life course with each other. And the thing that was most astounding to me is that when we told people our story of what we were going to do, people would say, how can you spend that much time together? I could never be together with my wife 24/7.
So what do you...
I heard that as well.
But Brad, I'm curious, what did you learn about each other during that year, do you think?
You know, it solidified what we already knew. We just wanted to be each other. We were with each other. We were best friends. Certainly, there were trials and tribulations, but we didn't really encounter anything that was challenging because we just solved problems together. And, you know, we just so thoroughly enjoy each other's company that it was just the best way to start our life. And, you know, now that we have two children, they're 7 and 9, and we just spent 5 weeks this summer in Ecuador traveling with them. And we got the same kind of comments. You know, how are you going to travel in a country like that with your little kids and, you know, get along with each other the whole time? And we just kind of say, you know, we just really love to be together and to, you know, see the world.
Oh, that's just a great story. Julie, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Julie Buckles. She's a reporter and freelance writer in Wisconsin, teaches journalism at Northland College up in Ashland. She's the author of Paddling to Winter, a couple's wilderness journey from Lake Superior to Northern Canada. When we come back, we would love to hear from you. What are some of your favorite Wisconsin rivers or lakes to paddle? And have you been on an adventure with a family or a loved one? I'm curious to know how it affected your relationship. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can always email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strange Champs, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tonight at 10 on Snap Judgment, it's Snap Live in Los Angeles, an amazing evening of phenomenal stories, and you have the best seat in the house. I'm Ann Strange Sampson. We're talking with Wisconsin writer Julie Buckles about her memoir called Paddling to Winter. And Julie, I was talking with Erica Janik the other day. She's the editor for Wisconsin Life, and you've done a couple of essays for her. And she commented that she read this book once about a couple who rowboat in cold northern places. And there was a chapter on rowing around Labrador that begins something like, "If I were a country, I would be Labrador." And then the author kind of goes on to talk about what it is in her personality that draws her to the starkness of the north. And I'm wondering, is there something in you that draws you to winter, do you think?
You know, the winter piece is something that it didn't come naturally. I grew up in Wisconsin, southwestern Wisconsin. I'm a driftless girl and grew up on a farm. And I don't know that winter was like, woohoo, I love winter. But when I moved to northern Wisconsin with Charlie, I just decided that you have to, if you're going to live in this climate, you have to embrace it. And so I took up cross-country skiing, and we took up snowshoeing and all the things that start to make winter very fun and something worth looking forward to. Getting sled dogs actually just took it to a whole nother level. And now, because I love my dogs and they love winter, we all can't wait to get more of it. But I don't know. Winter is so extreme and it's so stark and there's so much beauty in winter. And I do feel, I don't know if it's winter, but I do feel there's what happened on the trip is there's a piece of me that understands when you see men get all starry-eyed about the Great North and you don't quite get it. But when we went back up this summer with my children, I think I for the first time really got it, because there's something that I just felt when we got to the end of the road that was just like, oh, wow. I mean, it's just so vast and so stark. I don't know. I love stark. And
really, so more than just wilderness, it's something, it's a particular kind of wilderness that, and what is what is it that's stark?
Well, there's something about, well, it's just, there's just no people, for one. And there is a ruggedness. And I think more so than you feel when you go to the Boundary Waters. The Boundary Waters feels very much like a park where they let people come and experience the wilderness. The wilderness that isn't defined by boundaries, it just feels like it doesn't end. And there are people who live there. They don't come to visit there. And so there is just this different feeling you get when you get up and beyond into the Canadian subarctic that feels very different from, it's the end of our ecosystem, but yet the trees get smaller and there's just all of this like, wow, the people who live here are tough. And there's something I really do appreciate about that. Maybe that's that Midwestern ruggedness that we all appreciate.
I'm getting goosebumps. It sounds amazing. Let's hear from some other folks who might have stories to share. Barbara is calling from Spring Green. Hi, Barbara.
Yes, I so appreciate this conversation. I've been a lifelong wilderness addict, really, and when you're trying to talk about what it is, that word, that stark that came up about what's important about wilderness, for me, it's a kind of intimacy and a powerful connection that really nobody has any words to describe. I think I keep trying, everybody keeps trying, but anyway, in terms of the whole project and the book, which I appreciate. I spent the last 10 years as a park ranger in Alaska in a remote mm-hmm. site where I was out for 2 months without, you know, any amenities. And couples would come through who had been backpacking for 10 or 12 days, you know, over glaciers and crossing mountain passes and everything, including honeymooners who, when they arrived, were not quite certain maybe they had chosen the right activity for their honeymoon. but you can be quite sure that it was most memorable. And a couple days later, after a hot meal and a shower, they probably were quite certain that they had chosen the right activity for their most memorable honeymoon.
Did they all look happy?
They were exhausted, to be honest, because I think, especially coming from Brooklyn, Alaska is so different than even anything, and I don't mean to be disparaging of the wonderful things that we have in the lower 48, but it is wilderness there. There's no campsites, there's no trails, there's no, you know, it really is wild, and if you have trouble and get lost, there's no cell phone, there's no, you really have to be self-sufficient, and it can be dangerous because it's above timberline, you're crossing glaciers and glacial rivers, and there's a lot that can go wrong, mostly hypothermia. There's bears everywhere, which people are always afraid of, but the bears really aren't the problem. The bears are much more afraid of people because mm-hmm. it is wild country, but hypothermia and running out of food and thinking that you can rely on a GPS, which immediately gets wet or loses its batteries or something like that. You know, those are all the kinds of things that happen so often. But I'm afraid that...
Gee, you make it sound so attractive.
Well, it is. But I think it's a sort of a dying art. I mean, I think it's an endangered value in our culture. So that's why I really appreciate this book.
Oh, well, thank you so much for calling. And let's also hear from Tom in Viroqua. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning. I do a lot of canoe camping myself, and I noted on the cover of your book you have a photograph of a nice vintage traditional wooden canvas canoe, and I'm curious as to what canoe you actually did use, make, and model, and how well it served you.
Ah, there's a story. You guys made your own canoe, didn't you, Julie?
I love that you asked that question. Thank you. And Viroqua is my hometown, so it's and I was at Bramble Books last week. So hello to Viroqua. We built that as our actual canoe that we took on the trip. And that was an element of our trip that we haven't yet talked about, but we spent 2 years preparing. And part of that preparation was we did build our own canoe. It's an E.M. White guideboat, 18 and a half feet. And we built it with Jerry Stelmach, who lives in Maine, and he's a master canoe builder. And we drove out in January and spent 10 days with him building the canoe and then finished it at home. But other things that we did is we did maple syrup and turned it into sugar, and we gathered wild rice, and we really wanted to make this a trip not dependent on fossil fuels and lots of the gadgets and the dried meals. We wanted it to feel like a life, and so we took foods that are very good for you but yet don't have to be packaged in little plastic things. And so that was part of our two-year preparation, but it was the canoe building and gathering the food.
Mm, that sounds amazing. We've got a couple of emails I wanted to read. Valerie emailed to say that she and her husband call canoeing the Kickapoo, river down here in southwestern Wisconsin. They call it couples counseling because by the end of the summer, the water is low and the river is very windy. And if a couple is still on speaking terms by the midpoint, they're okay. And then we also had Heather posted on Facebook. She says that after graduating college, she intended to hike the Appalachian Trail, and her father joined her on the 7-week, 1,200-mile hike of the southern half of the trail. She says, "We shared a two-person tent through many different and challenging conditions. What a memorable way to reconnect with my father while finding myself after college."
I love that.
Yeah. I was going to ask you also, as a writer, I'm curious about writing outdoor stories. I mean, I think our last caller was talking about how difficult it is to put the wilderness into words. I'm curious about how hard it must be to capture an experience that's so physical in words.
Yeah, and I think you have to just skip over trying to define the wilderness and those abstract types of notions. I think with this book, I really did what all good writers do, is I focused on character, and because that was what interested me most. And if you're writing about what interests you most, that it's probably going to be interesting to other folks. But really just looking at what the types of people we were meeting and that the landscape would fall in naturally because of the actions of what we were doing and the dialogue. And, a couple of years ago, I didn't even understand what creative nonfiction was. And then I read John Krakauer's Into Thin Air and was just absolutely riveted.
The Everest expedition.
Yeah, and how you recreate a story and make it entertaining as well as informative. And I thought with that, I was just like, that's what I want to do. And, that's why I went to graduate school, was to really explore what creative nonfiction was. And for those who don't know, because it's a really funky term, but it's really taking the elements of fiction, which is why we all love to read fiction, and combining it with nonfiction. And so keeping the story true, but writing it in a way that feels like you're part of the adventure. And so I knew I had to focus on, and the writing really started to snap to life. In graduate school, during one writing session or writer's workshop, someone said, "It feels like you're writing this as if someone's looking over your shoulder." And I realized, while I didn't physically have Charlie looking over my shoulder. I had him in my head. And I was writing it as we did this, we did that. And when I started to separate out who really did make that decision and what went on in that decision-making process, did our characters start to come to life, and therefore the book started to come to life. So that was really a useful lesson.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Let's get to a few more people. We've got Gene on the line from Oshkosh. Hi, Gene.
Hey, good morning. I have a diminutive version of that trip. And it's a CO-17 Alumacraft, by the way. And it's been in the Pacific, the Atlantic, and picked up by a tornado in Kansas.
Oh, my gosh.
We decided to get married after 4 dates in 10 days.
Wow.
True love. There may be another book here for you, not for me. We're both in our 80s now. We've been together. We're very happy. We've raised a family. I've taught at 6 different universities. But
did you have a wilderness experience?
Long-term experience does not continue the way you expressed your long-term relationship with Charlie. In other words, we were different people. We are different people. So that as we've grown older, my love for the outdoors remains, while my wife is much more of a lady. And I wonder how that would fit together with, you know, that dichotomy would fit together in the book, a book similar to what you've read.
Have you both, Julie, stayed equally connected to the outdoors, you and Charlie?
Yeah, and I think I feel in some ways like I took over Charlie's thing. But we do it together. I wouldn't say that I am someone now who goes out and recruits other people to go and go off into the wilderness. I guess I really do see it as part of it's our touchstone. And if I think we had 1 year right when we were having our second child where I just thought we can't do the Boundary Waters this year. We can't do a trip. And it was the first year we had not done a trip since we met. Our very first date, you know, was on the Potomac River paddling. I was a farm girl who had never been in a canoe. And here, Charlie just couldn't quite fathom that that was even possible. But here we were. And so he took me paddling on the Potomac. From that time, every year we have gone paddling. And I see it as a touchstone for our relationship and now for our family. And so without it, I feel that year that we didn't go, I felt like something, we're off kilter. We're going further off kilter. And it's kind of the wilderness that brings us all back together every year and reboots us and helps us move forward.
Well, I'm
so
curious.
I wouldn't say that I've turned into more of a lady. I'm not a lady at all. I have. I go dog sledding and snowshoeing and skiing and do the Berkey. And no, I love being out there.
Julie, did writing this story and revisiting that trip and your memories, did that experience change you in any way? Did you rediscover parts of yourself you'd kind of drifted away from?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the 2 years after we returned were really kind of tough years. One, I felt like I was a deer in the headlights for a long time after we got back, just dazed a little bit. I had gone from being, you know, Julie of the wilderness to suddenly being left with the decision of which tomato paste to buy in a grocery store of 28 brands. We were going to have children, and that's one of the decisions we made on the trip was we decided to have children, and suddenly here I was having miscarriages, and I just could not believe that my body that had taken me 1,700 miles was not going to give me children. And so there was a lot of doubt of physically. But writing the book really brought it all back. It's like, that's who I was. I like that chick. And so it was really fun to write the book to rediscover that person who said, yeah, let's go.
Well, it's been great talking with you this morning. Thank you so much. Julie Buckles is a Wisconsin writer who teaches journalism at Northland College in Ashland. She's the author of Paddling to Winter. Today's producer, Marika Sival, Dave Potraz, kept everything running smoothly and sounding great. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Always fun being with you here on Fridays. It's 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio.